Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation. It is Monday, January 6th. It's been less than a week since a New Year's celebration turned deadly. It was a multiple casualty event, and it left people shaken, including our first responders. Today we hear their perspective. We invite you to join our roundtable talk with the city's emergency services director, Dr. Jim Ireland, and our fire chief, Sheldon Howe. We also hear from Hawaii's Healthcare Association about the coordinated effort to transport a half a dozen burn victims to an Arizona long-term treatment center. At this hour, Arizona officials are planning to provide an update on their care. Join in the conversation. We want to hear from you. The numbers to reach us are 808-941-3689 on Oahu or toll-free 1-877-941-3689 on the neighbor islands.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Ulupono Initiative and Ruby Tuesday Hawaii.
A large portion of Scotland's carbon footprint comes from one commodity, whiskey.
We have distilleries on remote islands, we have distilleries in highland locations, and we have distilleries in the main centre of population, where Glasgow and Edinburgh. There are different challenges that come with each of those.
Challenges including how to make the industry greener. That's next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Support for HPR comes from Osher Lifelong Learning Institute for ages 50 and older, with courses from art and film to history and gardening. Classes begin January 21st. More at olliuhm.org.
You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Today, joining us live in our studio is Dr. Jim Ireland, director of the Honolulu Emergency Service Department, and Honolulu Fire Chief Sheldon Kalani Howe. Welcome to you both. Today we're talking about the New Year's Eve mass casualty event here on Oahu. It has now claimed the life of a three-year-old boy, raising the fatality count to four. You know, the fireworks blast also injured about two dozen others. And Chief, Dr. Ireland, you both were at that news conference on New Year's Day. And I know Governor Green tried to caution us about that there could be more fatalities. But I guess it's just heartbreaking, you know, to hear that this latest victim is so young. Chief?
Yes, it's a very tragic thing for a three-year-old to lose a three-year-old, anyone to lose it. But someone so innocent. And, you know, we want to have our condolences and prayers again go out to the families that are affected, because it's going to be a long healing process. But again, yes, we just heard about that news about that three-year-old. So that's some very sad news for us to hear about that.
And Dr. Ireland, you know, you were there on the scene that night and, you know, you had to set up the triage and saw these victims.
It was tough. And that three-year-old was in an ambulance when I got there about 15 minutes after the event happened. So I didn't see that three-year-old, but our teams took care of him, and teams with EMS and the Honolulu Fire Department, and got him to Kapi'olani and did everything they could for that boy. But we still have this outcome, and it just makes it that much more tragic, and it's tough. And I've told people that when you get into EMS and these other first responder professions, we do see tragedies, and we do see things that are very, very sad, but not to this scale. And so many people are critically ill. And when you have children involved, it just makes it that much worse.
And Chief, maybe you can talk about, you know, what it was like when you folks got the call and you had to set up this coordinated response.
Yeah, the first call came in. Usually when calls come in, maybe the nature of the call that comes in really kind of gives us a heightened sense of what to expect. The first call came in as it was more for an investigation. It was a neighbor down the road saying that their neighbor blew up some fireworks and it damaged their home. There's no injuries. So that, then when our first unit responded, we only sent one unit. And so what they're thinking is something just going to damage, something damaged the home. No one's injured. So of course it's, you don't have that heightened sense of, you know, something's bad is happening. As they're responding down, there's more calls coming in. And the calls come in, there's they talk about maybe four injuries, but nothing to the level. We only can get that heightened sense when we get this information from the callers. So only as the information starts rolling in, then we kind of start getting a little larger scope. And it wasn't until our first arriving unit arrived at scene approximately 7 minutes after the initial 911 call is that we finally understood what we were dealing with and the total scope and destruction of the actual alarm. And what was described to me as it looked like a war zone. Our initial arriving fire captain stated this, as soon as they parked their apparatus, over 10 people just, you know, it's like moth to a light, right? All the insects coming to a light. Everyone needed help. At that point, he knew that this is something much larger and he needed help. So they initiated to our dispatch and more units were sent out. And what they described, again, was a war zone. And the initial reports from our personnel is what you would, just the patients coming up. A person had his clothes completely blown off of his body. And from what they thought initially looked like soot was actually their skin being burnt. So our unit arrived at the same as one EMS unit. EMS units stayed further down the road. And initial, we have to do what they call a triage, figuring out, you know, what we got, how many injuries we have. And he basically started sending people down to the EMS unit down the road. And just to get a scope of how far away that was, it was difficult for our guys to even get to the incident address. But imagine this New Year's Eve, people out on the street, fireworks going off, even his communication is getting off of the truck. You have all of these fireworks continuing to go off, people just surrounding the truck. It was actually difficult just to traverse down that roadway to get to the incident address. And just people all over the place. So it was very chaotic, very loud. He did a great job at setting up and really getting that ball rolling and setting up the command system to be able to coordinate all of the efforts. And so sent the initial patients, the walking wounded, as we call them, down to the waiting ambulance down approximately 250 feet away at the intersection of Keaka and Bikini Drive. And at that point, they did the best they could with the personnel that they had.
And Dr. Ireland, I know you had talked about the narrow streets and their cars parked on either side, and the ambulance needs 10 feet in the fire trucks, right, to get through. And you didn't know if there were still more fireworks and that the personnel could also be in harm's way.
Right, and like the fire chief said, that, you know, this came in as, they only got two 911 calls initially. And so one of them a little later did say four injured. So one of our assistant chief of operations, Jeff Cirkenick, happened to be out that night just supporting our team and going to calls. And they'd gone on the call an hour earlier of a firework incident in Kalihi where the person, the 20-year-old, ultimately lost his life. So that was a critical call. So the ambulance went and he went, and they were the first there from our EMS side. And he's been doing EMS for 30 years, Jeff Cirkenick, and I could tell in his voice this was much more serious than four injured. And he said, I have six critical patients. And then quite quickly after that, he said, I have 10 and there's at least 15 and maybe more than 20. And then at that point, I started responding and he asked how far I was away. And I could tell that he needed help. And then he confirmed that there were fatalities. And so It, as the chief said, it became very clear with a little bit more time that this was a really a big incident and there were a lot of people hurt. But because of our relationships with the other first responders, it went as well as I could have hoped and asked for, with fire department personnel doing exactly what they're trained to do and needed to do to save lives, EMS personnel, paramedics and EMTs doing what they needed to do, and help from the Federal Fire Department and Police Department ultimately. Salt Lake Boulevard was the transport hub where the ambulance could come in and out freely. Police shut that down for us, and at one time, any one time, we had three or four ambulances parked there to receive the victims. Really, the communication center, both, you know, EMS, fire, and police did phenomenal. From the EMS side, our whole night shift that was supposed to get off stayed over. One name in particular, a dispatcher who's also a paramedic named Ron Wolf, manned the radio that night. He was the voice that I heard most of the night, and he was decisive. He was calm. He was authoritative. He was flexible. Everything we needed him to be for us on the scene to get through this. Meanwhile, we had dispatchers in the background, you know, calling for mutual aid, giving updates, and really touching base with all the hospitals on, number one, to warn them that they were going to see things tonight that they had probably never seen before in Hawaii anyway, and how many patients exactly could they safely take care of, even knowing they had to call in extra staff. So I couldn't have asked for a better response from our entire team. I saw police officers and police commanders I knew. I don't know all the firefighters, but Rescue 2 Company, I recognize those personnel, and they were, you know, in the thick of it, carrying victims down to the transport sector. And I just couldn't be more proud of the team we had there and what they did, and at the same time profoundly sad of just what was happening and what happened to that community that was there for a night of fun.
You know, we did talk with Hilton Rathel, the head of the Hawaii Healthcare Association, just about the coordination, because this was very complicated. We hadn't seen this incident before, this mass casualty incident. And he talked about a new tool, a new dashboard that was very helpful in this case. Let's hear what he had to say.
This is a system that electronically connects every hospital in the state, and all the data goes into a dashboard. And there is an automated feed from every hospital in the state that goes into this system, and it comes from their electronic health record. There's no manual intervention involved. It's just a script that runs, and about every 6 to 10 minutes, there is an updated feed from every hospital into this system, and this dashboard then tracks down to the unit level, not only the hospital level, but down to individual units within hospitals, the census in those units. Now, EMS has access to that. The Department of Health has access to that. HIEMA has access to that. So they can tell, they can log in from anywhere around the world and look at this dashboard, and they can see how many patients are in each of these units, how many patients are in each hospital, how many patients are in each emergency room, how many of those patients in the emergency room have been assigned to a physician. So it's a real-time database or dashboard that gives access to all the hospitals. So hospitals can see what's happening at other hospitals, and EMS and the personnel in the ambulances can dial in, and they can see at any point in time which hospitals have capacity, which hospitals may be full or close to being full. And that is a great tool for being able to manage and triage care in incidents like this.
And that was Hilton Rathel with the Hawaii Healthcare Association. You know, he was talking about the triage area, and Jim, I know, you know, when you have to put a triage in place, that you have to figure out which patients are the most critical and who needs help right away.
Yes, and what Hilton was referring to, this dashboard, it's live in our EMS dispatch. Now, the ambulance crews don't log into it. You know, they're going to calls and stuff. I don't want them looking at screens like that. But our dispatch does have it and use it really every day, but they definitely used it that night. Probably the best technological advance we've seen that help us move and distribute patients in a long, long time. But yes, our district chief, Shara Molina. Well, let me back up. The incident command was one of the fire department's battalion chiefs, and Chief Howe can talk more about that. But our assistant chief of operations, Jeff Sukernick, was EMS incident command under the fire battalion chief. And then he had assigned Shara Molina, one of our district EMS district chiefs, to the triage officer. And so as she received patients, she would assign them worst first to the ambulances that were going to transport them. But we estimate there were probably 40 people injured in this incident, 35 to 40 people. Some immediately left on their own. They didn't wait for EMS to get there. And I think there's three children that had been hospitalized at Kapi'olani. You know, sadly, we heard one pass today. We only took one child to the hospital, so those other two found their way there by other means. We had about 10 or 15 walking wounded, minor injury patients that asked us, can we just take a car to the hospital, or can my friend drive me? Or parents said, can we take our child? And with the minor injuries, we said, yes, go ahead. So of the 21 we transported, I believe 19 of those 21 were critical. They were triaged as red. So then you have to decide which critical are more critical. And again, as the fire chief said, many without their clothing, skin was sloughing off. I mean, it was really, really just severe, severe burn injuries. And, you know, this may leave the news cycle in a week or two, but these people were going to be in the hospital. There's going to be some of them still in the hospital on 4th of July when we're confronted with this behavior again. And that's really hard to wrap your head around.
Yeah, and, you know, Chief, I, you know, heard descriptions of how, yeah, they had closed down Salt Lake Boulevard so that, you know, you could have a clear path for the ambulances to get to the hospital. I was hearing stories of how patients were being transported by slings, you know, just an incredible outpouring to get the help that they needed right away.
Yeah, so, you know, I wanted to really emphasize, you know, what Dr. Ireland said. It was the coordinated teamwork of not only first responders, but actually those bystanders on the scene. So initial reports that HPD had a large presence. They came in right to the scene, and they actually helped our initial arriving company help clear that actual structure. It's a three-story home, and they actually helped, went in and helped clear out that area. And, you know, when you talk about these tools of this technology being efficient, making sure that the patients get to the right place, I just want everybody to understand that the work that everyone did. Our first arriving unit arrived 7 minutes after midnight, and within an hour they have everyone pretty much transported to the hospitals to receive whatever care they have. And that's only possible with all of the coordinated effort with everyone. So our role as with HFD, as Dr. Ireland stated, we come in as the incident commanders. We take charge of that initial scene. And because of our training that we do with each other on a continual basis, everybody just kind of fell into their roles. EMS stayed down at the triage area. And from the triage area out into Salt Lake, that's where they had the transport all set up. So just so everybody can imagine the scope of coordination and the distances we're talking about, from the incident address to the triage was over 250 feet. From the triage area to Salt Lake Boulevard, about 480 feet. And when you talk about patients being moved in slings and blankets, and some of the patients were carried by our personnel to the triage area, just literally carrying them like a baby, adults, firefighters carrying adults down to the triage area, 250 feet away. Neighbors bringing their own carts, officers coming in, we use whatever that we could to get the patients down into the treatment area as soon as possible. So, you know, that's a kind of coordinated effort and help, and everyone should be, you know, proud of what they did. Even the community, like I said, stepped in to help.
You know, Jim, I think in a scene like this too, you've got different kinds of injuries that you're trying to sort through. You know, the projectiles, the shrapnel, and, you know, and the burns. That must have been just very hard for your people, too.
Everybody had burns. Every single person I saw had burns. And most of the 21 we transported had critical burns. I also saw people with shrapnel and in impalements, wood, metal, glass, big pieces protruding from human bodies. So this was not only small particle shrapnel, but large impalements. There were some people who had fractures. So it was a fire burn incident, but also an explosive traumatic incident. People said they couldn't hear. And I didn't put it all together that night, But I found out later a lot of the victims had their tympanic membranes, their eardrums ruptured from the blast. They couldn't hear. So it was just a very difficult, challenging scene on anybody's standard. And I know worse things have happened on the mainland, more fatalities. There were more fatalities in Maui, the tragic fire there. I understand there was something, I think that day or the day before in New Orleans, that was extremely tragic. But for us in our big, small town, this was a difficult situation that I would say the police, the fire department, and EMS were so professional and so near flawless that this they saved all the lives that could be saved that night. And again, proud of just everybody's teamwork, and at the same time, just profoundly sad.
Yeah. Well, if you're just joining us, our guests in our studio are Honolulu Emergency Service, Medical Service Department Director Dr. Jim Ireland, and Honolulu Fire Chief Sheldon Howe. You know, we're talking about the coordinated response to the mass casualties as a result of the illegal aerial fireworks, and some of the descriptions, you know, are graphic, but that's the reality of the situation. We would like to know what you think. Let us know by calling us at 941-3689 or toll free 1-877-941-3689 from the neighbor islands. We're going to take a pause now, but we'll be right back.
Marketplace is here to help you make sense of this new economic reality. We know that you rely on trusted journalism to navigate this uncertainty, and that's a privilege and a responsibility that public media takes seriously. And we are committed to connecting the dots for you through these times. So please join me, Kai Rizdahl, every weekday on Marketplace.
Beginning this evening at 6, following All Things Considered.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Honolulu Waldorf School.
You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. You know, Chief, we were talking about a mass casualty event, and I was just racking my brain to try and think of the, you know, some of the news events that I've covered as a reporter. You know, Xerox shooting was one of them. But you talk about how frequently how rarely it is that we get a call for something of this magnitude.
Well, this type of alarm is very infrequent. The last one of this type of magnitude, when we talk about mass casualty incidents, there's different levels. Level 1 is up to 5 patients. Level 2 is 6 to 10. Level 3 is 11 to 50. And then 50 to more is 4. So the last large event we had was back in 1999, the Sacred Falls event, where, if I'm not mistaken, 8 individuals passed with over 50 individuals that were injured. So we're right in that area or that scope of how many people that were affected in that same level. So this could be a once-in-a-career type event for all of the first responders. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we can drill and train as much as we can, but, you know, to be honest, sometimes these events, you're only going to see it maybe once in your career. Very, very, very tragic. And one of our companies that actually responded to this alarm just an hour earlier went to that fatality in Kalihi. So you went from one traumatic event and then having to deal with this other tragic event. And as the captain was trying to prepare his crew and letting them know that, hey, this is what you're going to see. Even he said once he arrived at scene, no matter what he could tell his crew, he could not prepare them for what they actually saw.
You know. And I'm sure there's probably the same for you folks, Jim, you know, your people. How can you prepare for something like this?
Yeah, and again, to see one person is tragic, but now with 20 and the injuries were so severe. You know, one of the things that's changed throughout my career in EMS is, you know, when we look back at the Xerox shooting, most of the EMS personnel that went to that scene left EMS. They left it as a profession or got out of the EMS field work because they were so profoundly affected. And so now we emphasize peer support following not only this, but even if just we have a really significant incident that's with a child or a real tragic death or multiple fatalities. And so we have a wonderful peer support team. Jenna Altamari, Natasha Garcia, Sonny Johnson, and others kind of spearheaded that, Rochelle Ortiz. And they pulled everybody together Friday, just this past Friday. It's voluntary, but you can come and talk about things. And I couldn't get to that at a conflict, so Jenna came to my office and kind of gave me a private mm-hmm. peer support, which I appreciated. And it's just a chance to have an open discussion about your feelings and what you think, and just that ability to talk about things. And peer support's ongoing, but it's so important after an incident like this because we're human beings and we're affected by this, and we have to go back to work. Yes. And it's a career that people love, and we want to go back to work, but we really have to look out for each other's mental health as well.
We do have a caller on the line from Haleiwa. Cullen?
Yes, hi.
Yes, what's on your mind?
Oh, first of all, I just wanted to say hi, Jim. Colin Steinberger, Ocean Safety Lifeguard. You actually were in the hospital when I got hurt. But I want my two cents on this is all I wanted to do was add a little bit of a small light at the end of the tunnel for this one is that very burn unit that you guys sent those six patients to in Arizona. In 1993, my mother, who was a acting physician at the time, was in a car accident on her way home after a shift, burned over 75 to 80% of her body, third-degree burns. She spent almost 2 years in that very particular burn unit in Phoenix. And she made a full, not a full recovery, but she did live 37 years after the incident. So that is something I just kind of wanted to throw in the mix for this because there's a lot of people going back and forth about everything. And that was, in my eyes, a good move. And I do have a very, very positive experience as far as the outcome with that particular facility.
That's great to hear.
Yes, that Colin, thank you so much for sharing that story. I'm sure that'll be a comfort to the families who have loved ones that are there in Arizona. You know, when we talked to Hilton Rathel this morning, he did talk about the capacity issue because Straub is our only burn center. And while the other hospitals were able to treat patients and stabilize them, it's very specialized care. Here's what he had to say.
The challenge there is that the incidents like this happen very, very infrequently, and it's very expensive, you know, to hire doctors, to hire nurses, to get all this equipment, and this is the largest incident of this kind in, you know, 25 years that I've been here in Hawaii. So no hospital in the state can afford to have people sitting around. You know, you staff for what happens on a regular basis with some excess capacity. Now, while Straub has four dedicated burn beds, they have the capacity. They can expand into their ICU. They can expand into their CCU, which is their coronary care unit. So they can expand the number of burn patients they're taking care of at any point in time. So while they have four dedicated beds, they can actually handle a lot more patients than that.
You know, and I know that Hilton had mentioned that those patients that were transported to that Arizona burn unit, it's specialized care, and that there were like five medical personnel tending to each patient. So there were 30-plus people on that military plane that transported folks over this weekend. So, people need to just think about the treatment that's involved. This is going to be long-term care for everyone.
I mean, a burn, as the caller said, or one of our lifeguards used to be part of my department. They are now their own department. I'm really happy for all our lifeguards who are outstanding first responders as well. they, as he alluded to and mentioned, that his mom got wonderful care there, and I'm glad that we have that option to send people. But imagine if Straub wasn't here. Imagine if we had to send 25 or 30 people to the mainland. Again, these folks could, he mentioned his mom was in the hospital 2 years. Imagine being outside the state for 6 to 12 months. And, you know, when people start popping on the 4th of July, and I hope we don't see the illegal aerials we did this New Year's, but these, a third or half of these people may still be in the hospital.
Yeah, it's a sobering fact that we have to deal with. And, you know, I know Governor Green tried to drive this home during his news conference. You know, he talked about, you know, organic matter, you know, I guess brain matter across the way. And yeah, the reality is fireworks probably blew somebody's brains out. And it's just a horrible thing to hear. But if that's the reality, that is what we're dealing with and the risks that we're taking.
That was the difficult part, hearing that just few houses down after the incident happened, that people were still resuming the aerials.
Yeah, and you know, credit to the fire department, because they are always the one first and foremost leading the charge for safety. As recently as, what was that, Chief, 2 months ago in the hearings?
Correct.
Yeah, so they see it. They go to fires. They know the danger. And you know, we really should have learned our lesson from Maui when they lost a whole town. Not because of illegal fireworks, but the same thing could happen here. And when I look at the old communities in Kaimuki and Eva Beach and Kalihi and the small lots and the wood houses, it's concerning.
We have another call on the line. Michelle from Kaneohe, you have a question or a comment?
Oh, actually, more of a comment, and I would really hope that our legislators really, really put some teeth into the laws that already exist. My heart goes out to those in Salt Lake, but I really do hope there's some criminal prosecutions that happen, because obviously this was not a stash of just somebody having fireworks to blow off for one New Year's. This was horrific. And every year we hear about people being injured. Somebody loses a hand, loses an eye, has a head injury every year, and it's only been getting worse. And every year it seems to be happening earlier and earlier that these homemade bombs are going off. I live in a little pocket in Kaneohe in a townhome complex, and every year I stay home on New Year's, listen to the aerials going off all over the neighborhood, because people hide out at He'ia School where it's dark, or the parking lot behind, or they shoot them off in the parking lot right behind Kahuhipa Street, and it's like a war zone. And this year it was almost every night from Halloween on. It'll happen again on Super Bowl, 4th of July. Those of us who have, all of my neighbors have pets, and everybody I know has been complaining that, geez, their animals are traumatized. And, you know, I feel like I had to shut my place down completely, shut all my doors and windows and draw the curtains at 6 o'clock, because there was just so much going on all around me, you know, all around our complex. So, you know, I feel like, why should we have to be held prisoner in our own home?
Yes.
When I first moved here in 1969, people were, you know, blowing up strings of fireworks, and there'd be red paper all over the streets with people sweeping up the next day. And yeah, it was smoky.
Right, but it's gotten so much worse.
Nothing like the homemade bombs that are going off. And even after this horrific tragedy in Salt Lake, even up to last night, there were people setting off bombs somewhere here in Kaneohe.
Yes, thank you so much for calling in and underscoring that point, because it's happening in my neighborhood. I'm sure it's happening in both your neighborhoods, Dr. Ireland and Chief. You know, we are going to have a second show later this week talking about the enforcement aspect of it, and we hope to have someone from the police department as well as the law enforcement department to talk about some of these enforcement issues. But is there anything that you gentlemen want to say about enforcement? Because I know the city council did try to allow for more consumer fireworks to be used.
Correct. I think the, you know, Bill 22 came out, and we opposed that bill as for consumer fireworks. And the reason we did that is back in 2010, we had the ban for consumer fireworks. And based off of statistics alone from a fire perspective, that we saw over a 60 to 70% decrease in fires alone. So that's something that our stance won't change. You know, our job is to keep the community safe. And so from our perspective, we'll continue to, our stance will not change. And in light of what happened in Lahaina, and basically it's an ignition source that started that fire in Lahaina. Now you're having fireworks. If you bring back consumer fireworks, it's my opinion that those fountains, those sparklers, those jumping jacks, ground flowers, they're going to be used by younger children. And so you have something that's going to be used with that younger generation. And that's why we feel that those numbers, the reason why those numbers in fire-related calls dropped since 2010, very significant. But as the proliferation of illegal fireworks has gotten increasing, then you see more of the injuries. Slight increase on the fire side, but more the injuries and just the scope of the injuries that people are getting is increased.
We have another call on the line. Damon from Wahewa, what's on your mind?
Hi, good morning. I just wanted to just express my appreciation for first responders and for the job that they do. My youngest daughter was delivered for my first responders, so I have a deep appreciation for what they do. I just wanted to comment on maybe as citizens here, I know it's a cultural thing, it's celebratory, it's, you know, the fireworks, but we really got to think about the consequences of what we do with these illegal fireworks as a community and the tragedy and even the danger it puts first responders in. You know, I think we just got to really think about that, and the legislature really has to sit down and think of ways we can stop things like this from happening in the future. That's all I wanted to say.
All right. Thank you for that. And Jim, you know, you've responded to many different incidents, whether shootings or fires or explosions like this. I don't know. Is there anything you want to say to the public just about what you've seen and what your people have been through?
Well, I saw a statistic in a national media outlet that said there's eight firework-related deaths in the entire country in the entire year. Eight. And we now have had five and maybe more from one evening on Oahu. And so we could tie or surpass the national fatality rate in one night for all the deaths in the entire country. And that just makes me pause to how bad this was. You know, and not only that, four or five people that night, separate from this incident, lost their hands, or at least parts of their hands. Last year, a year ago, it was eight people. So we are seeing, as the chief said, escalating injuries from the illegal fireworks. But all fireworks can cause a fire. And I think in light of now what we've learned about Lahaina, we just really have to look at this differently. And if there is new legislation, maybe we should look at this three-year-old as being in his name to bring some sanity to our celebrations. And the governor mentioned maybe we need more government-funded professional fireworks shows so people can still have that thrill of seeing the show without the danger of what illegal fireworks brings.
You know, we have another call from Maui. Bobby Becker. Question? Comment?
Hi there. Yes, as an ex-nurse, I would like to just have people also consider the incredible cost to all of our systems, the EMS, the police responding, all of our first responders, the hospital care that they're getting. For somebody who's going to be in the hospital recovering from burn injuries for, let's just even say, 3 months, it's going to be close to, you know, multiple hundreds of thousands of dollars. So the cost to society for the joy of making all of these booms and bangs and aerials is really truly something that I think should be considered as well. I recognize that, you know, for most people it's about the human cost, and I definitely have a lot of empathy for that, but there are other costs as well to each of us. So that's my comment.
Thank you so much for that. And, you know, Chief, I was sitting having breakfast with my family on New Year's morning, and we saw a fire, black smoke billowing, and we were like, oh my gosh, the fire department just is not, you know, getting a break after dealing with the tragedy from overnight, and you're still putting out fires.
Yeah, personnel are ready to go 24/7, and you know, luckily at this alarm, there were still some unexploded fireworks in the vicinity at that location, and I'm just grateful that didn't also go off. But when we talk about danger to the first responders, that's still a hazard that we have to consider. So upon arriving at the scene, they put out all of the smoldering fires, but right at the end of the driveway, there was a van that was full of unexploded illegal fireworks as well. And that's why the HPD came in and they brought their bomb squad in, and I think they're confiscated those fireworks as well. So yes, it even at this incident, just being operating in and around that residence was very hazardous to our personnel. The structure was not sound. It was a very hazardous environment.
I mean, yeah, we were very fortunate that no other homes burned, because you don't know, you know, if folks have ammunition, guns, or whatever in their homes, you know, and probably legally, but you just don't know what other risks that you folks might be, or bad situations that you're being thrust into.
Yeah, so we're very blessed that it did not come with a fire as well. So you would have to imagine all fire personnel, that's what we would be focusing our attentions on. And we wouldn't have been able to provide the level of care that we did for those that were affected.
Anything you want to say, Dr. Ireland, just about your people and the response?
I just am, again, reflective and very proud of what the fire department, EMS, and the police department did together that night to save lives in that most horrific incident. And I knew everybody worked to the best of their training and to the best of their ability. And again, without a lot of discussion, with just knowing what to do. And part of that's training. And sadly, this training has become is because of some active shooter training we've done, where we have a lot of victims from that type of instance, which I never, ever want to see here on this island. But everybody just performed so well that night. You know, the battalion chief, incident commander, overall the scene, our EMS incident commander, with their teams, just did everything they could and correctly to save lives. And it just, I'm very proud of them.
Is there anything on your wish list as far as equipment or personnel?
Besides no aerials?
Yeah, besides that, yeah. you know, I don't know. I don't know what your vacancy rate is, you know, in both of your departments.
For us, we are very blessed that we have very low vacancies here at the Honolulu Fire Department, and we have all the necessary equipment that we need for these types of incidents. And again, I just want to echo what Dr. Ireland stated, that we're just so proud of the work that all of the first responders did in doing what they did. And again, within an hour, coming up to the scene, not really knowing what to expect, and just performing, adapting on the fly, ensuring that they get all the patients, the care that they needed in that short span of time. Within an hour, they were all out in the ambulances on their way to the hospitals, getting the higher level of care that they needed.
Yeah. And then you need more personnel.
Well,
Dr. Ireland,
we just finished an academy. We're doing a hiring from KCC. So actually, we're going to have the lowest vacancy rate we've had in 20 years come next month. But we do need to grow. We need to expand to meet the increasing challenges of just an increasing call volume. I think in my mind, this re-emphasized the need for combined training. We already do it, but I think more is better. So I, the other thing that came to mind is Shara Molina, our district chief who ran the triage for this incident, about a year ago, we did a rail training, and it was well publicized. We did it with the fire department,
right.
And it was mimicking a rail emergency. And Shara was our EMS incident commander at that. She was, you know, she did that. It was a scenario. It was a drill. But I look back and reflect on that training and how it probably helped her for this incident. And so I think if anything, although we do joint training, I'm looking forward to doing more because it just makes everybody better.
You know, I'm just thinking, you know, we've got Chinese New Year celebrations coming up at the end of this month, right? You know, we have 4th of July as well. I don't know if there's anything you want to say to people who still may have unexploded fireworks that they're holding on to. I mean, I know that the Department of Law Enforcement has talked about trying to do an amnesty day to get people to turn in these things, but it just seems like, you know, that department did a heck of a job, you know, busting a lot of these containers coming through the harbors, but there's still so much that got through, as we saw this, you know, this past holiday.
So we do have an amnesty for this Saturday, as I think the state has one down at the Aloha Stadium. I don't have all of the details. We're going to send one of our companies down there to assist, and they can turn in their fireworks with that amnesty program. And, you know, people have to realize that when we talk fireworks, we're actually talking these are explosives. And so when these fireworks or explosives make their way into the harbors and then gets distributed, you have explosives that's being transported on our roadways. Then you have these explosives being stored in a residence that is not up to fire code and how to store these explosives and the quantities, and they don't have fire sprinklers. So, you know, when we go to these everyday calls, if you go to an auto accident, our first responders may not know that there's explosives in the back of a trunk of a car. You see, and then also going through a structure fire or any type of home, we don't know what we're going to come up against. So I would hope that the people would take this tragedy and think twice about using it, and hopefully that they would participate in this amnesty that's going to happen on Saturday.
All right. Okay. Well, we'll try and get more details about that so that the public knows. If you do have those illegal aerials that we would hope that you would do the right thing and turn them in, just given the severity of this and given the death of the 3-year-old child that we just learned about this morning. You know, it's...
I'm going to interrupt real quick.
Yes.
I don't know if you... Well, I'm sure you remember, but about 12 years ago, I think we lost 5 people that were dismantling fireworks.
Yes.
And that was
storage area.
Professional company that undid illegal firework acquisitions, and they had a mishap at the Waikele bunkers, and I think it was 5 fatalities from that.
Yeah, and the fireworks, if they're sitting around, they can become unstable and become more of a risk for our firefighters.
I think that was in about 14 years ago or so,
yeah.
The Waikele bunkers.
Yeah,
yeah, and so it's scary because you don't know how these illegal fireworks are being stored. What are the risks that our first responders face when they get a 911 call to go to something else? So, yeah, pretty scary stuff, really, when you think about it. But I don't know, any final thoughts as we prepare to close down the hour, the hour, and anything? Any appeal you want to make?
No, I just, again, being so proud of the work that our personnel did and their diligence. And, you know, one thing that I wanted to share is one of the patients was almost completely buried in the rubble. And she wasn't found until a little further on in the incident, right? We're trying to deal with all of the walking wounded and the patients that we can see. And upon our search and rescue component in the search, one of our firefighters was using his flashlight and a thermal imaging camera to pick up any kind of heat signature of a body and or a person to just look around. And he thought he saw what he thought was an elbow. And when he looked closer, it was actually one of the victims who was completely buried under all of the rubble. And it took 3 to 4 firefighters to remove the rubble. It took several minutes to get out. And unfortunately, that was one of the victims that passed. But once they found that out, our incident commander made a decision that he knew that there was children involved. They went ahead and they researched the house, flipped over every bit of debris, just looking under cars, into cars, in the bushes. It's just the amount of effort that they took to ensure that they got everyone.
And Jim, you know, Dr. Ireland, you talked too about the fact that your people were out there trying to respond and had to probably deal with the trauma of seeing limbs in a scene like that.
And like I said, it's nothing that we don't come across in EMS. We're used to dealing with very, very critically injured and ill patients, but just the fact that there were so many and the injuries were so severe made this almost unique in the scope of how big it was. And to be initially surrounded by so many critically ill patients, like the engine was and like our ambulance was, because they were the first two on scene. That's it. Two apparatus. And to each get surrounded by 10 or 12 people that were that critically injured momentarily is overwhelming, but there is training that we all go to, fire, EMS, it's incident command system, it's triage, it's calling for backup and resources, and all of that went very well that night. And kudos to the commanders who, from all agencies, that ran that scene. Even though I'm the director, I wasn't running the scene. I was there to support as a physician to help. But they ran that scene, and we will learn from this because we're going to teach future generations about what we learned there. But just what they must have felt to be that overwhelmed, to have to fall back on your training, is really just a testament to, again, them as professionals and their training. And to be handed a three-year-old as the initial ambulance that was that critically injured is, again, not only hard as a provider, but it's just hard as a human being to just see that.
Yeah, and I recall seeing a story that there may have been a two-month-old, I don't know, a baby. I'm not sure if that somehow got garbled in the reporting, but.
Well, again, there were three patients at Kapiolani admitted to the hospital. The one passed today, as we know, sadly. And we only took the three-year-old. So the other two, I believe, must have went by private car, maybe before the first responders got there. Parents may have just thrown them a car and just booked it to Kapiolani. So we definitely know more children were injured, three serious enough to be in the hospital. The ones I saw a little later in the evening had minor injuries. They definitely went to the hospital, but I think they went by car, and I don't think they were injured severe enough to stay overnight. But any traumatic incident or incident that has children mixed in with the adults makes it just that much worse because, again, they're completely innocent. They were just there with their parents and families at a party.
And you do want to find out if there are any folks out there, you want to try and survey, who brought the walking wounded in to the ERs, right?
We're going to talk to the hospitals because I really think it's important to get a better idea of how many people were injured in this. And again, there's a police investigation, the fire department did an investigation. That's okay. Not EMS's role, but we would just like to know the numbers.
Right. Well, we'd like to thank our guests, Honolulu Fire Chief Sheldon Howe and Dr. Jim Ireland. And we'd like to thank you, the listener, for joining us on today's show. Have a comment to share? Please call our talkback line at 808-792-8217. You can also send an email at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. And if you want to listen back to today's show, check out the Conversation podcast at hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.